The country shuts down, but the president has high hopes for Easter and cruel taunts for Mitt Romney. It's all part of a What Else Is New edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Have the White House briefings on the coronavirus become little more than Trump campaign rallies?
You know, my view is whatever Trump says now, I just disregard. I want to hear what Fauci has to say.
Plus, what's left of the presidential primaries?
Nobody ever wants to postpone primaries, certainly. You know, nobody's happy that this is happening, but, you know, to protect their voters, protect their citizens, a lot of officials feel like they have no choice.
And we hear from Steve Forbes, who recounts his unsuccessful run against George W. Bush and reflects on how the Republican Party has changed. It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 321 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. This is a tough time for everyone, not just political junkies, but it is especially tough when you're focusing on a health crisis, a serious health crisis, that on the face of it should have nothing to do with politics, but to our dismay, has politics written all over it. Why, for example, and if this is true, but why is it that Democrats are washing their hands more thoroughly and more often than Republicans? Why are Democrats more inclined to avoid large crowds or gatherings than Republicans? Why do Democrats have such little confidence in President Trump's leadership role in this crisis, while Republicans have great confidence in him? These are questions that won't be answered by this program, or anytime soon, for that matter. But it tells you a lot about the state of America in this troubling and unsettling year of 2020. One thing especially troubling and unsettling, or should be anyway, is Trump's frequent penchant for cruelty. Case in point, Mitt Romney, who is 73 years old and whose wife has multiple sclerosis, decided to self-quarantine after learning that Senator Rand Paul, with whom he had been in contact, has tested positive for the coronavirus. When Trump was told this by a reporter at one of his health press briefings, he had this response.
Romney's in isolation?
Yes.
Gee, that's too bad. Go ahead.
And on Wednesday, after learning that Romney tested negative for the virus, he tweeted this. This is really great news. I am so happy I can barely speak. He may have been a terrible presidential candidate and an even worse U.S. senator, but he is a rhino, and I like him a lot. This from the guy who says we need to take politics out of the mix. It's times like this when the rubber meets the road, as we saw with President Reagan in 1986.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss.
And President Clinton in 1995.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens. It was an act of cowardice, and it was evil. The United States will not tolerate it. And I will not allow the people of this country to be intimidated by evil cowards.
And President Bush in 2001.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror.
And President Trump in 2020.
Yeah, no, I don't take responsibility at all because we were given a set of circumstances, and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time. Wasn't meant for this kind of an event with the kind of numbers that we're talking about.
The coronavirus is not Donald Trump's fault. He should not be blamed for the pandemic. But months of denial and mixed signals may have confused the public and may have delayed many people from taking it seriously. And that is troubling. That should be troubling to anyone, regardless of party. Meanwhile, we still wait and see what Bernie Sanders will do. 4 years ago, when he was competing with Hillary Clinton, he didn't endorse his victorious opponent until mid-July. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Since 1972, when presidential primaries began to determine the nominee, what non-incumbent Democrat clinched his or her nomination the earliest? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Remember this day, March 2nd, 2020. The place, Charlotte, North Carolina. The speaker, well, you know who he is.
8 months from now, we're going to defeat the radical socialists. We're going to win the great state of North Carolina in a landslide. We won it last time. We're going to win it this time by even more. This is an incredible time for our nation. Our country is stronger than ever before. And today we just had the largest one-day increase in the stock market in history. And you know, you hear about enthusiasm for crazy Bernie, and that's true. He does have some enthusiasm, but much less than we have, and a much smaller group of people, too. And there's not a lot of enthusiasm for, Biden.
I want you to remember that date because that was the last time President Trump had a campaign rally. The rapidly spreading coronavirus ended not only Trump's Keep America Great rallies, but those for the two remaining Democratic candidates, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Biden, his party's almost certain nominee, and Sanders have been all but invisible since the last primaries a week and a half ago. Not Trump. As the nation's self-proclaimed wartime president, he's been on TV every day, ostensibly to update the country about the virus, but a good portion of what he says is either questionable or simply not true, or has nothing to do with the topic at hand. And if nothing else, Trump gets another opportunity to bash the press, which he delighted in doing at his rallies. Here he was at one of last week's infomercials.
I don't know if they're sitting like you people are sitting. You're actually sitting too close. We should probably get rid of about another 75-80% of you. I'll have just two or three that I like in this room. I think that's a great way of doing it.
If he had a bit of a smile when he talked about getting rid of 75-80% of the reporters, he wasn't smiling with his response to NBC's Peter Alexander, who asked a very simple and unthreatening question.
What do you say the Americans were scared, though? I guess nearly 200 dead, 14,000 who are sick, millions, as you witness, who are scared right now. What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say.
Go ahead.
I think it's a very nasty question, and I think it's a very bad signal that you're putting out to the American people. The American people are looking for answers, and they're looking for hope. And you're doing sensationalism, and the same with NBC and Comcast.
So
I call it Comcast. Let me just ask for whom you work. Let me just say something. That's really bad reporting. And you ought to get back to reporting instead of sensationalism. Let's see if it works. It might and it might not. I happen to feel good about it, but who knows? I've been right a lot. Let's see what happens.
Remember, this came at a press briefing designed to share information about this pandemic. He doesn't hate all the press, mind you. He has his favorites, such as OAN, the One America News Network, whose unfailingly pro-Trump agenda hardly makes it a legitimate news organization. But even when he gets a suck-up question about whether his calling the coronavirus the Chinese virus is racist or not, he still goes back to his favorite theme.
Mr. President, thank you. I have two questions. Do you consider the term Chinese?
OAN.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Treat me very nicely.
Do you consider the term Chinese food racist? Because it's food that originates in China or it has Chinese.
No, I don't think it's racist.
On that note,
I don't think it's racist at all.
On that note, major left-wing news media, even in this room, have teamed up with Chinese Communist Party narratives, and they're claiming you are racist for making these claims about Chinese virus. Is it alarming that major media players just to oppose you are consistently siding with foreign state propaganda, Islamic radicals, and Latin gangs and cartels, and they work right here at the White House with direct access to you and your team?
It amazes me when I read the things that I read. It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative. It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post. Because, you see, I know the truth. It's really, I mean, I think I came up with the term. I hope I came up with the term, but it is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news.
And this leads to a difficult but necessary question. Should the networks continue covering these Trump briefings live? With self-congratulatory rants, with overly optimistic reports about vaccines that have yet to come, about a pandemic that may not be as severe as the doctors are telling us, about packing the churches in time for Easter Sunday, is there a risk in broadcasting these news conferences? Jack Ohman is the Deputy California Opinion Editor at the Sacramento Bee. Jack, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine, and I hope you're doing well, too. I saw you a couple of weeks ago, and California was already on near lockdown, but I'm glad to hear that everybody's well, so that's good news.
I think I sheltered in place probably the morning after I saw you, so I've been inside for 2.5 weeks now. And parenthetically, I think California's done a magnificent job here. And there are a lot of states that you can't say that about, but along with New York and places like that where, you know, you're getting the straight gouge from your governors and they're competent and moving and acting, it stands in rather stark relief to what's going on in the White House.
I think you're absolutely right. I think what Gavin Newsom's doing, what Andrew Cuomo's doing, what Larry Hogan in Maryland is doing, what J.B. Pritzker in Illinois is doing, Mike DeWine in Ohio, these governors are basically doing what one would think the president of the United States should be doing, that is taking action and reassuring a very nervous public.
And I think, interestingly, one of these people may wind up being president of the United States because of it. And I have a couple of names in mind. And this is what leadership is all about. Number one, it's about effective communication. And I think that the governors you cited, Republican and Democrat, have been very, very effective and very clear in how they're communicating with their constituents. And they're competent people to a person, which leads us to where we are now, which is, you know, we were kind of bumbling along through the Trump presidency hoping nothing like this would happen. And never in our wildest dreams did we ever think that this sort of asymmetrical problem would arise. I think a lot of people were worried, oh, he'll get us in some stupid war or he'll cut the hell out of, you know, some social program or the other. And who could have predicted this? And so now you've got state leaders taking decisive action and literally trumping the president on his own turf.
Well, let me ask you the question that I asked in the intro. Is there a risk in broadcasting these news conferences live, given the potential for misinformation, things like that?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that Dr. Anthony Fauci is currently the President of the United States, with Vice President Pence being the training wheels. And, you know, my view is whatever Trump says now, I just disregard. I want to hear what Fauci has to say. I want to hear what, you know, what Pence has to say. I want to hear what the Surgeon General has to say. And when you're in an environment where the President of the United States is an asterisk at his own news conference trying to provide leadership and calm the nation, that's a pretty damn sad state of existence for this country. I'm rather confident, though, that these people, not Trump, particularly Fauci and some others, are schooling him. Interestingly, even Governor Cuomo said a couple of days ago that when he's on the phone with Trump, it's a different experience. You know, he's, quote, very engaged, he's, you know, helpful, and then, you know, he gets up at a lectern the next day and says, you know, kooky things. And it's a very troubling experience.
Well, I want to get to Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, who's also up there behind the president at these briefings in a second. These are important things. But I want to, I know there's never been a president like Donald Trump before, and I know that attacks on the media should not be surprising, but, and I think this expands on what you were just saying, Jack, that at a time when we need calm and we need facts and clear judgment more than ever, do the networks have their own responsibility to decide whether airing this stuff? I mean, I know how you feel about Fauci, and yes, everybody looks to him for leadership, but of course he is not the president of the United States. He's not the one who will make the ultimate decisions. And so when Donald Trump says, you know, I think everybody will be back to work, or at least back in churches by Easter, I mean, sometimes you could see the look on the face of Fauci and others on the stage and say, wait a second, we're not ready for this yet. But the point is, do the networks, do the TV networks, do they have a responsibility, given the fact that people are listening to every word that's coming from this White House? Do they have a responsibility to either, I mean, you know, they would talk about a 7-second delay, but maybe just air the press conferences later, making sure that the facts are correct?
I think the networks are in a very difficult position here. They want to err on the side of disclosure, and yet there have been so many conversations over the course of the Trump presidency about, you know, what kind of a platform the networks have given this guy. And, you know, you can just think back to all the airtime that he got in 2015 about Obama's birth certificate and stuff like that. And, you know, I really do think most of the network people I've ever dealt with have been very smart, very well-educated, very thoughtful people. And yet at the end of the day, they're trying to make numbers too. And so you're putting them in a position of making some sort of selective news judgment in a crisis. I mean, it would be like, you know, the only news analog I can think of where this is kind of like a slow motion Cuban missile crisis. And so, you know, who's making the decisions about what gets aired and what isn't is critically important. And so I guess in my view, I think that we'll just air these things and then they will analyze them afterwards, no matter what. I mean, I think some days Trump has a good day, a quiet day, and then the next day he's spouting off someplace or the other. And it tends to be when he's in a more freeform environment. And then the next day he will roll back whatever it is that he said. And so I don't know that it is the network's function or responsibility to be the president's editor. Their responsibility is to cover the news, whatever it is. And at the end of the day, I think they're basically making proper judgments about what goes out and what doesn't.
When I see the president up there talking about all those who have died from the flu, as if he's trying to make the point that the coronavirus is not much different than the flu, for weeks, the audience on Fox News, for weeks, if not longer, were told that this was all a plot to hurt Donald Trump, that it was all exaggerated. Devin Nunes even said this less than 2 weeks ago.
It's a great time to just go out, go to a local restaurant.
Yeah.
Likely you can get in easily. There's, you know, let's not hurt the working people in this country that are relying on wages and tips.
I just wonder if those who were listening to the commentators on Fox, to Republican politicians, to the president himself, they may have put themselves at risk by minimizing the threat. That's the only thing I'm just worried about.
Well, of course they put themselves at risk. I think when you selectively channel what information you want to hear, when you demonize, quote, mainstream media, which anybody who works in, quote, mainstream media, unquote, knows that we're bending over backwards to be straight on everything, aside from the opinion pages. And we, you know, that's where we're supposed to do this sort of thing.
You know, you mentioned earlier, you mentioned Anthony Fauci, and I'm glad you did, because sometimes, you know, he's the guy I look for the most on that stage. You know, I look to his facial expressions to see if the president is being straight with the facts or not. And when Fauci is not on the stage, then I immediately feel the worst, like he's sick or he's been silenced or he's been fired. I mean, I don't remember anybody. I mean, usually when the president gives a briefing or a speech in the middle of a crisis, I never think of looking at some of the people behind him on stage. But my goodness, Anthony Fauci seems to be irreplaceable.
I am an optimistic person. I was raised by a PhD research scientist. And I think that those folks are getting the information out, and that the people who are listening very carefully. And I think that there has been, even with Republicans, a certain segment of the Republican Party, there's been a seismic shift in perceptions of what this is, including the president's, where, you know, 2 months ago he was saying, oh, this is just like the flu, and we have the flu every year, which is true. You know, 700,000 people die of cancer every year in the United States. 550,000 people die of heart disease in the United States every year. People die of things. And, you know, there's this fine line between, but you never hear anybody talk about that, right? And so this is scary because it's somewhat more transmissible than the regular flu. And the people who are getting it tend to be, you know, older, at-risk folks. Not all of them, but the most of them. And so there's this kind of, I quite frankly am more troubled by the social Darwinism aspect of this, where the president and the governor of Texas and whoever else says things like, oh, well, you know, excuse me if it wasn't the governor of Texas. I'm sorry, it was lieutenant governor of Texas. I don't want to misattribute that, you know, hey, you get old, you die. This is one of the things you die from. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, the Dow is up 11.4% on Tuesday. And so we're going to get through this. It's going to be bad. But do you go to a network and say, censor it? No, I don't think so.
Sometimes you wonder what is more dangerous, a health crisis like we're seeing now, or a government, or the lack of government honesty and transparency. I mean, neither is desirable.
I would quibble with that a little bit. I think that the government, that the appropriate agencies like CDC have been very transparent. And so Trump rails about the deep state and Republicans rail about the deep state, but it's the deep state that's keeping you alive right now. But I've been inspired, quite frankly, Ken, by the personal stories that I see every day where people are, for example, there's a sewing circle of old ladies who are making surgical masks, 150 of them. I mean, that sort of thing is kind of World War II stuff that we've forgotten about. And I'm way more reliant on their stories than I am on any storyline that President Trump puts out.
Jack Ohman is a deputy California opinion editor at the Sacramento Bee. Jack, thanks for being on the program, and thank you for your optimism. And that's the infection that I hope takes hold.
It is, and thank you so much, and it's always great to be with you.
I've been a fool so long, but now I know there's something in me. I've been like holding on.
Oh, no, I don't expect to see them all in.
was supposed to have been the day of the Georgia primary. It's been moved to May 19th due to the coronavirus. Next Tuesday, the 31st, three states were scheduled to have runoffs, including Alabama, where former Senator Jeff Sessions is fighting for his political life. That's now set for July 14th. These are just a few of the states that have moved the date of their primaries because of COVID-19. We like to point out that the Civil War didn't stop the presidential election of 1864, and World War II didn't halt the election of 1944.
San Francisco turns out to welcome the autocade of Governor Thomas E. Dewey touring the West Coast. The Republican candidate carries his campaign into California.
And maybe by November, this will all have been a bad memory. But for now, the risk of contagion is so great that more and more election officials are saying the risk is not worth it. They're moving their primaries up to May and June, hoping for the best. And even if we are still in the midst of a pandemic, it will at least give people the option of voting by mail. Zach Montalaro is following all this at Politico, and he's here with the latest update. Zach, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's almost hard to believe that there's still a presidential nomination to be decided. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders are still running, but with no more rallies to be held and no more campaigning by the candidates and people urged to stay home, there's obviously really no point in holding the primaries.
Yeah, you know, I do wonder how much of this is because, you know, the campaign has come to a stop, certainly, but also the Democratic nomination is not decided. It's not formally decided. But Joe Biden does have a fairly comfortable lead, let's put it that way. He's got a nearly 300 delegate lead that's just about mathematically insurmountable at this point. Some things would have to change quite dramatically. So I do wonder if that's played into the decision to postpone and push back all these primaries.
Well, that's a good point. And I can't help but wonder that what if it were close, like in 2008 with Obama and Hillary Clinton? I mean, it's one thing to right now to delay the primaries because it's really not, doesn't seem to be that close between Biden and Sanders. But what if it was airtight like it was in 2008? I wonder what that would have done to the whole process.
Yeah, you know, this is such an unprecedented situation. I think the last primary I recall being postponed was the New York City mayoral primary after 9/11. That was the last one I recall being postponed. But, you know, this is also an unprecedented crisis the country is facing, too. So it put the election officials really in a tough spot. Nobody ever wants to postpone primaries, certainly. You know, nobody's happy that this is happening. But, you know, to protect their voters, protect their citizens, a lot of officials feel like they have no choice.
You're absolutely right about 9/11 in New York City. That was the election where some guy named Michael Bloomberg, who's then a Republican, was elected. But yes, the Democratic primary was postponed 2 weeks. But back to going back to the present here, there was no Georgia primary this week. And as I mentioned, the three primary runoffs in the South for next Tuesday have been postponed. Now, on Saturday, April 4th, which is the next contest, or at least the next scheduled contest, there were primaries scheduled in Alaska, Hawaii, and Louisiana, and caucuses in Wyoming. What's happening there?
Yeah, so three out of those four states, Alaska, Hawaii, Wyoming, are actually all party run, meaning the Democratic Party in each individual state is running it. Alaska and Hawaii are party run primaries, so they should operate as you expect primaries to operate. And Wyoming is the last caucus, is the last, you know, like the Iowa or Nevada caucuses, that's what it is. But all three of them have canceled in-person voting, meaning you can't show up to vote in person in any of those three states, and have all moved to exclusively mail balloting and have all pushed back when their mail ballots are due. So that means we're not going to actually get any results on April 4th from any of those states, and voters are going to be voting differently. You know, in states like Alaska and Hawaii, they already have a lot of experience voting by mail. Hawaii, in the state-run elections, is actually already an all-mail voting state. But now voters there have to cast their ballot by mail, basically. And that's something we're seeing adapted, you know, quickly across the country.
Now, I noticed that Louisiana is moving its primary from April 4th to June 20th. But that's outside the window the DNC has set for choosing delegates. You know, their rules say that all primaries and caucuses must be held by June 9th. So if this is outside that window, June 20th, what happens to those delegates? What happens to that whole process?
I think the right way to think about it is we don't know yet. If this was a normal process, if we weren't under a pandemic, if you held a primary after early June, you would have half your delegates, you know, awarded, meaning that you were supposed to have 100 delegates just to make an easy number. You'd only get 50. Now, a couple of states have moved past that, you know, early June date, but we're in the middle of a pandemic. So, the DNC's rules commission will have to grant some sort of waiver for this. And I'm sure there's discussions ongoing about that. But it's one of those things that, like, we're in a situation that we weren't expecting to be in, you know, 2 months ago, let alone when these rules were written. So it really will fall on the DNC Rules Committee to kind of make that decision what happens to these states. I would be shocked if there isn't some sort of conversation in the works right now to issue some sort of waiver to allow these conversations to happen and allow these primaries to go on as scheduled, you know, after that June date.
I agree with you completely. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to be penalized for you know, going through this pandemic and having their election system try to work the best way they can. But I only wonder that, you know, I know there are some states have moved up their primaries to June 2nd. And, you know, if it's June 2nd or June 9th, why not have those dates instead of June 20th? But either way, I can't imagine them being penalized, them meaning Louisiana being penalized for having it outside that window. So I agree with you on that.
I think a big state to watch actually is New York, which hasn't quite yet moved its primary. You know, there's officials pushing for it. They would move to June 23rd. That's what the conversation is, because that's when the congressional primaries are in New York. So I can't imagine the DNC punishing New York, one of the biggest states and most important states in the Democratic coalition. But I suppose we'll find out. But that's why these states are, a lot of states pick June 2nd to avoid the window. But if you're in New York, if you're in one of these other states, you want to kind of push them back later just to be able to align with your already scheduled primaries and not, you know, pay a lot of money to run another election.
I was just going to say, if you have all the primaries, presidential and congressional, on the same day, June 23rd, that certainly saves a lot of money.
Right.
So the next state in the calendar is Wisconsin, which, as far as I'm seeing, is still supposed to take place as scheduled on April 7th. Why hasn't that been postponed?
Yeah, so Wisconsin's in a tougher situation than other states because Wisconsin not only has the primary that day, they also have some general elections. Wisconsin does spring general elections in certain offices in the state. That includes there's a state Supreme Court election up. The mayor of Milwaukee is up for election that day. So it's tougher to push back a general election because people have to fill these seats. You know, someone has to be the mayor of Milwaukee. You can't not have a mayor of Milwaukee.
I've always said that, right.
So that's why they're struggling to push it back. And, you know, they're encouraging voters to vote via absentee, certainly. They're trying to get people to vote early if they can, so kind of cut down crowds. But, you know, Governor Tony Evers in the state has really resisted pushing back that primary and that election day because of those general elections.
Is there a process already in place that will be getting these absentee ballots out to voters? Do you have to request them, or can you just send out ballots to all registered voters and hope they'll send it in by mail? I mean, how does this process work?
It's totally state by state dependent. In Wisconsin, they're really asking people to request ballots. But then actually Georgia just announced that for its primary, for its down ballot primary and runoff, which was postponed, that everybody in the state, the Georgia Secretary of State announced that every registered voter in the state who is an active voter, that's something like 6.9 million people, will be mailed an absentee ballot request form. So they still have to fill out the request form to get their ballot back. But that's like an unprecedented step. That's basically saying, here's this form. We want you to vote by absentee ballot. Please fill this out. And that's going to cost the state a lot of money to do, but they're doing it because that's the safest way they think they can go about handling it.
So I know that after Wisconsin, which is April 7th, the next primaries are on April 28th. And you already mentioned New York is wrestling about whether to postpone it until June 23rd. But there are other states up supposed to have primaries on the 28th, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. What's happening there?
Yeah, so the ones that used to be the second largest day in the calendar, the quote-unquote Accela primary, because the Accela train, the Amtrak train, runs through all those states. Most of those states have already postponed their primary, and if they haven't yet, they're looking to do so. Maryland has postponed its primary. Delaware has postponed its primary. Pennsylvania is in the process of doing so. So that state is real. That April 28th date, which was going to be the second biggest date on the calendar, has kind of gotten almost entirely obliterated. A lot of those states have moved to June 2nd as a sort of mini Accela primary, to also go with other states that are already planning on voting that day. But that April 28th date is a shell of its former self at this point.
I mean, I don't want to write Bernie Sanders. I don't want to prematurely end his campaign. I mean, it's obviously up to him. But if there are no primaries for a long time and there's no attention being played on the Democratic side, and he's completely, you know, there's no coverage of what the Democrats are doing, I wonder if that weighs into his calculations about whether to continue or not.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that the Sanders campaign projected that they, you know, they said if there's going to be an April debate held, the DNC initially said there'd be 12 debates with the last one in April, we're going to participate. So that makes it sound like he plans on staying in the race through April. Of course, we don't know anything about that debate yet because that schedule was set before there was a global pandemic. So we don't know if that's going to be held, but you got to think that the lack of primaries may be playing into Senator Sanders' decision to stay in. You know, Ohio saw their primary postponed, certainly. That was going to be a big state. Georgia saw their primary postponed. So a lot of states that Vice President Biden could have done well in have now been pushed back on the calendar.
And, you know, the question is out there. I mean, we're obviously not going to settle it right now or even answer it right now. But, you know, the question is out there. What happens if this is continuing into November? And what about that November election? You know, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. I wonder, I mean, that possibly could be in jeopardy. And of course, that would change everything, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that certainly would. You know, it's easier to postpone a primary than it is to a general election for a lot of reasons. The main one being primaries are controlled by the state. So a state can make the decision on its own. A state cannot decide to postpone the November election on its own, nor could President Trump. It's actually set by Congress. So any decision like that would have to come through Congress, and that would be an unprecedented move. What we are seeing is that a lot of states and a lot of officials are kind of pushing for expanding vote by mail, be it, you know, states that already have it or saying, hey, someone else should do this, or at least looking to expand absentee balloting. So that's kind of like the next frontier here to try to protect the election, is to allow people to submit their ballots over mail.
These are uncharted times, I know that. Zach Montalero is a campaign reporter with Politico. Zach, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, before this year in Illinois' 3rd District, who was the last woman to unseat a male incumbent of her own party in a House primary? The answer, Ayanna Pressley. In the September 2018 Democratic primary, she defeated Congressman Michael Capuano in Massachusetts' 7th District. Two other women, Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York and Republican Katie Arrington in South Carolina, also knocked off House incumbents that year, but Pressley in Massachusetts was the most recent. And the randomly selected winner is Stanley Green of Rochester, New York. Stanley wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, you can always find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
I'm all shook up. Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Ooh, yeah, yeah. I'm all shook up.
It's time for This Week in Political History. There was a moment, a very brief moment, back in 2000 when George W. Bush's march to the Republican presidential nomination seemed like it was in trouble. On February 1st of that year, he got trounced by John McCain in the New Hampshire primary, and again 3 weeks later when McCain beat him in Michigan. But on Super Tuesday, Bush won 9 of the 13 contests, including the delegate-rich primaries in California and New York. McCain suspended his campaign 4 days later. The race for the nomination was all over but the shouting. After McCain dropped out, the party began to coalesce behind the Texas governor. It was on This Week in 2000, on March 28th, that one of the candidates who hoped to win the nomination, magazine publisher Steve Forbes, endorsed Bush.
So there you have it. Two contrasting visions before the American people. Al Gore, status quo. Al Gore, more Clinton-esque evasions and corruptions. George Bush has a contrary vision of integrity and character, reform and renewal. He truly wants to reduce the burdens on the American people and increase opportunities. He's put forth positive issues and ideas. So there you have it. And so for all of these reasons, I unconditionally and fully support Governor George W. Bush for the presidency of the United States of America.
Now, I know, in the scheme of things, this was hardly a major event. But 5 years ago, when we interviewed him on The Political Junkie, it was an excuse to catch up with Forbes and compare the Republican Party in 2000 and the candidacy of Bush to the Republican Party of 2015, back when people were talking about another Bush running, his brother Jeb. Here's that interview from 2015. Steve Forbes, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Good to be with you, Ken. Thank you.
Well, in the event that some non-political junkies accidentally turned on this program and have no idea who you are, here's a commercial from your campaign for the Republican nomination in 1996.
I'm Steve Forbes. Our tax code punishes families. In 1948, a typical family paid only 3% of its income in federal taxes. Today, they pay 24%, eight times as much. No wonder it takes two breadwinners in a family to break even. I say scrap the tax code. Put in a low, flat tax. For a family of four, no tax on their first $36,000.
You were best known for your advocacy of the flat tax, and I don't think anybody knew about that before you brought that up in the campaign in 1996 and 2000.
Well, and since then, over 25 countries have adopted it. The total now around the world is about 30. The support for it is growing in this campaign. You heard Ted Cruz when he made his formal announcement. He almost used language from 1996, do the tax return on a postcard. So, and I know of at least four other candidates, potential candidates, who are going to advocate the flat tax. So it's 20 years later, it's come back to life.
Well, speaking about being ahead of your time, I think when you also ran in 2000, if memory serves, you announced your candidacy on the Internet.
And that was a big deal at the time. Now I guess the big one is what Cruz did on Sunday night before the formal announcement on Monday. He did it on with a tweet, yeah. which the one virtue is it's mercifully short.
Well, in back in 2000, you ran a very close second to Bush in Iowa, but you were out of the race, I guess, after the primary in Delaware and not long after you endorsed George W. Bush. What did you like about him in 2000?
Well, I think that the fact that he was willing to entertain a real tax reform, that he was willing to do things to reduce the regulatory burden, and he seemed to have that kind of can-do approach that I thought we needed. And the Clinton administration had run out of gas and was not willing to push reforms like Social Security, which Clinton was going to do until he got sidetracked by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So I thought some good things would get done.
When you last ran, as we said, in 2000, there was this guy named Bush who was a dominant figure in the party. How do you see the prospective 2016 field and that other guy named Bush?
Well, Jeb Bush clearly is his own person. He was a very good governor of Florida. In Texas, the governor does not have great powers. In Florida, governor has enormous powers, and Jeb Bush exercised those powers. He made enormous reforms on Medicaid and education. When he won the election, he put up the V signs and said that's not for victory, it's for vouchers. So he did a good job in Florida. Now, part of his challenge, he gave a very good speech in Detroit the other day, talking about economic growth, getting 4% growth rates, and now he's got to flesh that out in specific proposals. So I'm looking forward to those proposals, and if he does, I think people will see when this contest gets underway that he will be an impressive candidate.
Well, the other day you retweeted a column by Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal and had this headline, "Hillary is the only thing holding Democrats together, and Bushes always break the Republican Party." Did that mean I didn't understand it when I saw your tweet. Did it mean that you're not comfortable with Bush or you're willing to wait and see?
Oh, well, I'm willing to wait and see. And I think he is a very impressive individual. What was really interesting about Peggy Noonan's piece, I thought, was her take on Secretary Clinton, who is clearly in trouble with the base of her party. And if Elizabeth Warren runs, I think Elizabeth Warren would be a formidable challenger, just as Barack Obama was when he ran against then-Senator Clinton back in 2008.
Although Elizabeth Warren insists she's not going to run.
Until she does.
I guess they all do that, don't they? How would you assess, you know, we keep talking about how the Republican Party either lost its way or can no longer win with the kind of coalition that elected Bush in 2000 and 2004. How would you assess Jeb Bush's efforts to make Latinos more open about the Republican Party?
Well, first of all, he speaks Spanish fluently. Unlike his brother, who can do a few phrases, Jeb Bush speaks it very, very fluently. People pick that up very quickly. He was very inclusive when he was a governor of Florida, and his wife, of course, is Hispanic. So I think he would find it very natural to reach out to Spanish Hispanic voters in the United States. And I think key, though, for any candidate, whether it's Rubio or Bush or one of the governors, current sitting governors like Walker, is to have a vigorous pro-growth program like Reagan had in 1980. And that's why I think you're going to see the flat tax revived again as a major issue. You're going to see other positive reforms, not austerity, but real pro-growth reforms. And that's the key. We didn't have that in 08. We didn't have that in 2012, and that's what I think ultimately killed the Romney candidacy. People couldn't identify, all right, what actually is he going to do that's going to really get the country moving again?
Well, you're talking about the flat tax, and you were also talking earlier in the show about Ted Cruz and what he said about taxes.
Instead of a tax code that crushes innovation, that imposes burdens on families struggling to make ends meet. Imagine a simple flat tax.
And as you say, he also talked about, you know, filling it out on a size of a postcard, which was word for word what you said when you ran in 1996 and 2000.
Yeah, almost going to send him a bill for royalties, but I don't think that.
Well, what do you make of him?
I think he will be a strong candidate in the debates. He's very formidable, very, very bright. You saw that with the announcement, no notes, no teleprompter. And I think, but he's going to face a lot of very serious challengers. Governor Walker has got a lot of interest in the base of the party. Rand Paul, obviously, is going to be attractive to libertarians. He's going to announce in 2 weeks' time formally. And Governor Kasich, Governor Jindal, and others are roaming around. Senator Rubio may end up going in the race, and there are other candidates going in the race, Dr. Ben Carson and others. So it's a very strong bench, and the key is to you're going to have that distinctive program or bold program. And then when in the case of Cruz, Senator Cruz, what he's going to have to do is demonstrate that he can put together a good ground organization in Iowa and elsewhere, that he can raise resources through small donors. It's been done before. Barack Obama got some good chunk of his early money in 2008 from small donors. So he's going to have to demonstrate viability. We all know Jeb Bush has got a lot of money, a lot of contributions. And others may be able to get their own, but you got to have the resources, the platform, the resources, and the ground game, and that's hard to do.
Are you leaning towards a particular candidate?
Not yet. Recently, relaunched an organization called Americans for Hope, Growth, and Opportunity, nonprofit to promote the flat tax, a sound dollar, and patient control of health care. And I think the environment, especially for the flat tax, is going to be very ripe. We've updated the flat tax proposal. It's now a family of four. Back in 96, it was $36,000. Today, a family of four could be earning $52,000 of wages and not have to pay federal income tax, and above that, only 17%. So I think that's going to fall on very, very good soil this time.
Steve Forbes is the editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine and was a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 1996 and 2000. He can be found on Twitter at Steve Forbes CEO. Steve Forbes, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Ken, thank you. It was a good trip around down memory lane as well as the current scene.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
It was 20 years ago this week, on March 28, 2000, that Steve Forbes endorsed Texas Governor George W. Bush for president. His two subsequent choices, Rudy Giuliani in 2008 and Rick Perry in 2012, didn't fare as well. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. Money. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And please, stay safe, everyone.